We began Advent a couple weeks ago with a special service on a Wednesday night called A Liturgy in Blue. And for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, it was a service dedicated to facing our griefs and bringing them to the incarnation that we might be able to know what it is to hope, even when the world feels dark. And three of our own members stood with great courage and candor before us all and shared with us all their stories of grief that they faced in the last year. And the stories that occasioned that grief would make us all shiver, and what they're facing in order to work through that mourning is something that would all make us still and silent. And I raise that not to applaud ourselves. There are other places in our community where that kind of sharing takes place, but I do make mention of it because that moment was an important moment for our community, because it says to us all that this place will be a safe place in which we might share what really afflicts us and what shakes us to the core. And that's important stuff. But again, I don't reference that in order to applaud ourselves. I say all of that in order to set up what I'm about to say. They tell you in seminary that preachers ought not be self-referential in their sermons, because sermons are not, you didn't come to listen to me or about me, you came to listen to our ubiquitous God who is the hero of every passage of every scripture text. But I want to read you a quote. It's on the front of your bulletin. It was in the backstory this week, and it just so happens to be a quote that Sinclair Ferguson mentioned in his commentary on the passage that we're going to look at today, and it's from the Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard. Listen to what Søren Kierkegaard said a very long time ago. The greatest danger for a child where religion is concerned is not that his father or tutor should be a free thinker, not even his being a hypocrite. No. The danger lies in his being a pious, God-fearing man, and in the child being convinced thereof, but that he should nevertheless notice that deep in his soul there lies hidden an unrest, which consequently not even the fear of God and piety could calm. The danger is that the child in this situation is almost provoked to draw a conclusion about God that God is not infinite love. What Kierkegaard is saying is that it would almost be better for a child to be raised in an atheist household than for him or her to be raised in a household where there is a professed belief that nevertheless comes off as empty and hollow, where there is a world, a household that is characterized and marked more by, as he calls it, a hidden unrest than a pervasive rest. And when I read that quote, I was haunted to the core, because I had to ask myself, would somebody who knows me well characterize me as somebody who walks with a pervasive rest or a hidden unrest? How would you characterize your existence, your existential frame? Is it marked more by a pervasive rest or a hidden unrest? We're in the book of Ruth for the season of Advent, and in the chapter that we're going to look at today, it is all about the search and the finding of rest. Rest that has a particular meaning in this passage, but rest which has multiple layers of meaning, not only in the book, but in the entirety of the Bible, such that I'm going to argue that the rest of which it speaks in Ruth chapter 3 speaks to a rest that is meant to be in and through us all. And unless it's pervasively in us, we do not understand why the incarnation and why Christmas is merry. So we're going to look at chapter 3 of the book of Ruth. We're going to follow that storyline, and we're going to ask some questions along the way as we review it about what is this rest? What does it mean to live with a rest in God? And then we're going to see if we can find out what does it mean to find that rest. Rest is not something like an asset that you possess. Rest is something more like something that has to be born and reborn in you continually at every moment that threatens that rest. Am I right? So would you stand? We're going to let Dallas Cagle read to us Ruth chapter 3. Would you stand?
Ruth Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, should I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you? Is not Boaz our relative, with whose young women you were? See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Wash, therefore, and anoint yourself, and put on your cloak, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. But when he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do." And she replied, "All that you say I will do." So she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had commanded her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk, and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. Then she came softly and uncovered his feet and lay down. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. He said, "Who are you?" And she answered, "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer." And he said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after your young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask, for all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman, and now it is true that I am a redeemer. Yet there is a redeemer nearer than I. Remain tonight, and in the morning, if he will redeem you, good, let him do it. But if he is not willing to redeem you, then, as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until the morning." So she lay at his feet until the morning, but arose before one could recognize another. And he said, "Let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor." And he said, "Bring the garment you are wearing and hold it out." So she held it, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her. Then she went into the city. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, "How did you fare, my daughter?" Then she told her all that the man had done for her, saying, "These 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said to me, 'You must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law.'" She replied, "Wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today." This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
You may be seated.
The book of Ruth is a story about a family that's plagued with tragedy. A husband and wife and 2 sons leave a place that is supposed to be fertile, but is encountering a famine. They relocate to a place that has a sordid reputation. And while they're in that place, the region of Moab, the husband dies. And they stay there a bit longer, and those sons reach a marriageable age, and they marry 2 Moabite women, and then those 2 sons die. And so there is a mother without help, left to fend for herself, having only these 2 foreign daughters-in-law at her side. One remains in Moab. The other, whose name is Ruth, convinces Naomi that she wants to accompany her back to Bethlehem upon hearing that there is fertility back in that region. Ruth leaves everything she knows, everything she loves, because she has come to love Naomi, but more so because she has come to love the God of Naomi. Last week in chapter 2, we saw Ruth demonstrate a faith that both ventured herself and entrusted herself to God. And in that same chapter, we met this man named Boaz, a distant relative of the family of Naomi, who showed great respect and protection and provision and favor, all of that unto Ruth, but also unto Naomi. That's the storyline that we found thus far in the book of Ruth. Here in chapter 3, the truth that we find here meets our ears in a way that's about as foreign as can be. What happens is stuff that you like, what? What just happened? To this point, we have been gratified listening to an account about the sacrifice of a young Moabite woman to a people that she had not known. We've been touched by the generosity of somebody named Boaz in satisfying Ruth and Naomi in their urgent need of food. And all that registers with us, no matter how distant in the past that moment took place. Here in chapter 3, all the wheels fell off, because even if we're impressed with Naomi's intention, we are dumbstruck by what Naomi does. Okay? Back in chapter 1, Naomi prays for Ruth. Before Ruth says, "I'm going with you back to Bethlehem," Naomi says, "May the Lord deal kindly with you. May he help you find rest in your native homeland with another husband." She prays that for Ruth in chapter 1. Here in chapter 3, in the very first verse, she says, "My daughter, should I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you?" Naomi wants to be the answer to her own prayer. And the two words there in chapter 1 and in chapter 3 for rest, they refer to this sort of state of stability, this kind of provision that allows you rest and help. And in that context, the stability that Naomi's talking about is the rest that's afforded by marriage in that day. It's the same word, though, that threads its way through the entirety of the Old Testament. And it's a word that we find in God's mouth. It's a word that we found in Psalm 95 today in our service. It's a word that's speaking not just about a breaking away from labor. It's a state of composure that comes with knowing God. This rest is what it means to be in relationship with God. That's the rest that this is speaking of. The rest that has a particular meaning here in Ruth 3, but which has a larger significance to anybody that might have read it, because they know that when you hear the word rest, it means something more than just circumstances. It means something about an inner, pervasive rest. It's not a stoic, immovable detachment. And nor is it a naive optimism. It is grounded in the way things are. And it's a composure, even in the way things are. So that's sort of the near-in context and the wider context about talking about the rest that Naomi is referencing here. Rest in particular for Ruth, but rest in general for us all. That Naomi is looking out for Ruth's rest, that's a wonderful thing. But it's how Naomi seeks to find that rest for Ruth that makes us all flinch a little bit, right? Naomi's seen the generosity of Boaz so far, okay? She's taken note of the way Boaz has seen past Ruth as an immigrant and has actually treated her like an insider, just like an Israelite. And so she knows that Boaz is a distant relative of the family, which has certain significant implications. We'll get more into this next week in chapter 4. But in ancient cultures, including an Israelite culture, it was the practice of families that if a husband dies without an heir, there would be a brother or a near relative who would marry that widow and, Lord willing, bring forth an heir that carries on the family's name and allow the deceased husband's property to be retained by that family. In Latin, the word for brother-in-law is the word levir, and the practice that we're hearing about here, or that we're talking about here, is called levirate marriage. Naomi thinks that Boaz's generosity with grain might very well extend to taking Ruth as a wife. And so she's so confident that she believes she can provoke Boaz to taking that step by sending Ruth on what we might just want to call a rather unorthodox mission. She says, "Ruth, get washed up, put on some perfume, put on a frock that's going to hide your identity. We don't want anybody noticing or taking note of your presence. And then Boaz, he's out on the threshing floor. He's threshing the grain. He's going to get tired. At the end of the day, the boys are going to get together. They're going to eat. They're going to drink. They're going to go to sleep. Take note. Take note of where he falls asleep. And then when it's all dark, slip quietly down there, uncover his feet, and lie down next to him." And we say, "I'm sorry, what?" Boys, if ever a girl comes into your bedroom and lays down at your feet and takes the blanket off your feet, the first thing you do is run. You run. Okay? Every context has a context. Now, the narrative in this moment, if you noticed, is true to form. It is sparse. It is spare. It is unadorned. There is no evaluative language built into this moment. There is not like a, "Can you believe what she did?" or a, "Wow, look what Naomi did." It's just a statement of the facts. And so in that situation, it's almost hard to know what the narrator really thinks about Naomi's little plan that she's hatching here. Even commentators who study this text are split on whether we are to consider Naomi as acting brilliantly or brazenly. It's unclear. It's ambiguous. Is this a masterstroke on her part because she discerns the generosity and integrity of Boaz? Or is this an example of taking matters into one's own hands and putting people at risk, no matter how profitable the outcome might be? Both the language and the description of the plan is ambiguous. And so are we to revere her or are we to renounce her? And yet, what do we see Ruth do? She acts with resolve. She says in verse 5 to Naomi, "All that you say, I will do." Whether the idea of Naomi's is working in concert with the providence of God or whether she is trying to ride ahead of that providence, Ruth is at rest in this moment. She acts with resolve. She's a picture of rest. Rest in the goodness of God, even when you are uncertain about the soundness of a decision, either one that you make or one that's been made for you. There's a dissonance in this moment. And brothers and sisters, I don't need to tell you, life is dissonance. Moment after moment is filled with colliding, conflicting data, and yet life must be lived in the middle of the dissonance. You can't wait forever. You have to act at some point. Ask the Phetros, ask Mary Beth, ask the Paytons, ask the Puckets. Do you think that they are immune from the dissonance that comes with the changes that they're about to enter into? Of course not. But one mark of rest in God is that when whatever dissonance that you might feel is there in a given circumstance, you are not destabilized by it. That's a mark of rest. Yes, you might be able to make a case for arguments both for and against a particular way, but can you rest in the dissonance, trusting that God's goodness is not hanging in the balance, even when you can't see the way forward? That's rest. It's a picture of it. It's not the only example of rest, though. Dissonance about a particular plan is not the only thing that kind of threatens rest in this moment, right? Once again, Ruth is going to show us the way into rest, and she does that by doing just as Naomi instructed. What you do, I will say. She acts with care and precision, but imagine that you're Ruth for just a moment. It's one thing to think about whether a plan is sound or not. It's another thing to risk a deep personal rejection, and that's what she's doing here. She doesn't have any reason to believe that Boaz would be unkind to her. He's only shown her kindness thus far. But if there's anything clear about the narrative here is that no one knows for sure how Boaz is going to respond to this remarkable overture on Ruth's part. You don't know. And nevertheless, Ruth uncovers his feet and lays down beside him. Now, I've had an experience like this. Which I should now elucidate, lest I let your imagination run wild. I met my wife by sitting down to her at a table in the middle of a courtyard, and I asked her the very first thing, "How big is your father's dowry?" And she looked at me, as I've told you this story before, like when Leia looks at Luke and says, "Aren't you a little short for a stormtrooper?" That's what I felt. I was uncovering myself, if you will, and was facing the threat of rejection. When Boaz awakens with a start, with cold feet, imagine that, right? Strange woman at her side, he says, "Who are you?" And she says, "I am Ruth, your servant." And that word servant there is different from the word servant she used earlier. This word for servant means, "I am Ruth, an eligible woman. I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you're a redeemer." She's asking him to consider marrying her. But it's bigger than that, because she's using God's own words to make the proposal. In Ezekiel 16, you know what God says to Israel? When I passed by you again and saw you, behold, you were at the age for love, and I spread the corner of my garment over you and covered your nakedness. I made my vow to you and entered into a covenant with you, declares the Lord God, and you became mine. That phrase there that Ruth uses, spread your wings, is the same Hebrew phrase for spread the corner of your garment. She apparently knows her prophets already, and she hasn't even been a follower of Yahweh for very long. But she's using Ezekiel's language here, God's language, to make a proposal. And so she is pulling out the big guns to make her case for Boaz to marry her, but she is still risking rejection. Boaz could really say to her, "Oh, sweet girl, that's so very kind, but I cannot." And then what does she do? How does she leave there without feeling absolutely dejected? To venture herself in this way, to risk rejection, she has to have a kind of rest that's at work in her soul. You don't do that without a certain level of poise in your heart. Just like dissonance is a staple of life, the risk of rejection is a staple of life. No matter the course of your life, that life is inevitably marked by all kinds and forms of being passed over, forgotten, dissed, dismissed, or even reviled. It's unavoidable. But the mark of an inward rest is the ability to face both the risk and the experience of rejection with a courage and a composure. It doesn't mean that you don't feel disappointment at rejection. It's not about stoicism that rest is connoting here. It just means that in the rejection, it doesn't devour you. Do you know that kind of rest? Now, so far we've spoken of rest in God as a state that trusts in His goodness amid one's cognitive dissonance, and a trust in the acceptance of God amidst the prospect of not the experience of rejection. But the rest of God, the rest in God, also has to do with a settled conviction in His holiness. And Boaz is going to help us see that. When he awakes with a start, fetching woman at his feet, it's totally dark. Nobody can see a thing. There is no light. And Ruth's banking on that to conceal her presence, her intrusion into the threshing floor, right? And so with it being entirely dark, and with a woman, shall we just say, ambiguously placing herself at his feet, is she offering herself in more ways than a future marriage there at that moment? It's ambiguous, okay? It's all dark and everybody's asleep. No one would ever know if Boaz would take the liberty to do what married people do before a marriage had been confirmed. And yet Boaz sits there in awe of Ruth's devotion. And he says as much. He says, "This beats all. You could have gone after the love of much younger men." Look, Camelot, the 1960 version with Richard Harris and Vanessa Redgrave, that really doesn't capture the age difference between Arthur and Guinevere. You got to see the 1990 version of First Night with Sean Connery and Julia Ormond, right? Gray hair, little girl. That's the age disparity. That's what we're talking about here between Boaz and Ruth. That's why he's going, "This beats all." But Boaz neither takes advantage of her age or her offer or the darkness, because he is a man who, though bleary-eyed and his senses are blunted, rests, if you will, in the clear righteousness of God. He is a man at rest in the holiness of God, settled in that conviction of what honor and propriety call for. Brothers and sisters, the mark of rest in the holiness of God is a disposition toward living with integrity, even when the world is fuzzy and nobody can look. That's rest. And that's not a heart that's cultivated overnight. It's cultivated by a repeated acts of testing and refinement. There's one last example of rest, though. Boaz expresses his willingness to take Ruth as a wife, but custom required that he defer that request. And we're going to get more into that, much more detail next week. unless a relative defers, who has a more rightful claim to the offer that Ruth is making, Boaz could not take up Ruth on the offer of marriage. He couldn't do it. But in keeping with all else we know about Boaz, he looks out for Ruth's every need. He protects her reputation. He loads her up with more grain than she can possibly carry. And he even sends a little message through Ruth to Naomi in the provision of grain. You remember back in chapter 1 at our liturgy in blue, we heard Naomi say, "I went out full, the Lord has brought me back empty." Boaz says for Ruth to tell Naomi this: "You must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law." As if to say, "I see your hand in this, Naomi. And if I have anything to do about it, the Lord will bring you more fullness than you could possibly imagine." But for reasons that we'll address next week, all Ruth can do is wait. And that's why in the last verse of this passage, Naomi says to Ruth, "Wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today." Neither of them know what trajectory of kindness, whether it will continue or whether it's going to take a disappointing detour. But the mark of a deep rest is a capacity to wait with patience. Brothers and sisters, can you rest when all you can do is wait? We all have to learn to wait. And while we wait, we have to learn not to fret. We all have to discover a rest in God's good providences that allow us to rest and live with poise. There's rest. Resting amid the dissonance by trusting in the goodness of God. Resting in the face of rejection by trusting in the acceptance of God. Resting amid a moment of temptation by resting in the holiness of God. And resting in the meantime by trusting in the providence of God. All that showcases what it means to rest in God, to find your peace. But brothers and sisters, that whole passage and all of that begs the question. Yes, it may speak of manifold marks of rest, but what is to account for that rest to take hold in us? How do we become so convinced of the goodness, the acceptance, the holiness, and the providence of God? My wife and I have been watching Ken Burns' miniseries documentary on the Roosevelts. We finished it last week. Eleanor Roosevelt's story is as much a story of tragedy as it is of triumph. I really commend it to you. Everything Ken Burns touches is golden, but this one is particularly golden. This is platinum. Eleanor Roosevelt had an alcoholic father and a dead mother, and it changed her forever. And as you will hear the story, the marriage that she had great promise, but in time became a marriage purely of political convenience. But in watching that documentary of the Roosevelts, there is one quote from Eleanor's diary that I think typifies just how tragic it was at the center of her being, notwithstanding all of her heroic accomplishments. It's on the front of your bulletin. Listen to what she says about her sense, her thought about the perseverance of somebody else's love and loyalty. She said this in her diary: "Up to a point, it is good for us to know that there are people in the world who will give us love and unquestioned loyalty. I doubt, however, if it is good for us to feel assured of this devotion without the accompanying obligation of having to justify this devotion by our behavior." Oh my God. For her, there was no hope of a love that would ever abide if you failed it. The only love there was for her was love you had to merit for it to stick around. That's what animated her. And we think, what a tragic way to live. And then we realize, how much am I like that? How much have I internalized those very words? How much is my hidden unrest born of the very belief that any love that I'm ever going to get is only the love that I'm going to justify in receiving? Brothers and sisters, the incarnation is not something that we merely marvel at because it was miraculous. The incarnation is meant to help us find our rest, both now and forever. A rest that is born of a love that does not have to be justified by your behavior. He didn't come because you were lovely. He came because he was loving. And if you're not sure of that, for every one of those marks of rest you found in chapter 3, there is a corresponding part of Jesus' life and ministry that means to birth and rebirth rest in us. In this is love. There was no one that entered into a greater experience of dissonance than him. That he came at all, to leave all that he knew, to enter into squalor. That's dissonance. For him to sit there in the garden and pray, is there some other way? That's dissonance. And he entered into that dissonance so that you and I might not have to face our dissonant moments without peace. In this is love. He didn't merely risk rejection, he suffered rejection. He walked into rejection by men, by those closest to him, and for a season, for a finite time, even an unendurable rejection from the one who loved him the most, his Father. And he entered into that rejection so that we might not discover an ultimate rejection. And so that when we ever feel rejection from somebody on this earth, it will not feel like an ultimate rejection. In this is love. Jesus faced manifold opportunities to turn away from God in the daytime and in the night. When Satan tempted him, when he was tempted to be a king by a mercurial crowd, when the garden offered him a thought of a way out, he faced those temptations and rested in the holiness of God by obeying him. And this is love. Jesus didn't merely wait to see what might happen. He waited. He didn't just pace the floor. He waited in agony on a cross. He had to wait in agony without reviling those who put him there. He had to wait in agony without withholding love and forgiveness from those who put it there so that they might learn to wait on the forgiveness of God. The rest that abides, that is deeply going to be hidden in us, that will emerge vibrantly from us, is the rest that trusts in the goodness, the acceptance, the holiness, and the providence of God because we know of it in his love through the incarnation. That's the story you have to stick near. On Tuesday night at Martin Bond's inauguration as president of Redeemer Seminary, Greg Thompson, who's a pastor in Virginia, whose words I posted to you on the backstory this last Thursday. You know, if you listen to that, what he said at the beginning of his remarks before he ever said anything to Martin. Sally Lloyd-Jones was present, and she did a reading from the Jesus Storybook Bible, which held us all in rapt attention. And when she was done, Greg Thompson stood up and he said, "Sally, I have to thank you. Because a year ago, if you know what happened in Charlottesville, Virginia, a student at UVA from England was abducted and murdered, and the whole city was rocked, including Greg Thompson's 8-year-old daughter. So much so that she put duct tape on the blinds of her window in her room so that she might feel safe." And Greg Thompson said, "Sally Lloyd-Jones, thank you for writing this book, because I spent many hours on that bed reading that book to my daughter, that she might feel at peace, even in a world that is not at peace." Brothers and sisters, what is true for an 8-year-old is true for us all. Do you want to walk in peace? Then you have to stay near the story, the people, and the program of those who look to the one who came in love and who meant to make peace between us and God and give us that peace that passes all understanding. And then instead of living with a pervasive hidden unrest, maybe we'll learn to walk in rest. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.